There was some speculation that the CIA had done in Vietnam what the British Special Branch had done with similar radios they planted among communist insurgents in Malaya. Some contained hidden homing transponders, allowing the radios to be tracked electronically. Peanut's radios were inserted using ruses like lost rucksacks or packages left behind on buses in Viet Cong areas. Nasty boats floated hundreds ashore into North Vietnam. U.S. recon teams planted Peanut's radios in enemy base camps or left them along trails, and C-130 Blackbirds airdropped them into North Vietnam, inserting 8,000 in 1967. Blackbirds also airdropped another SOG Black PSYOP product into North Vietnam, so-called gift kits, like those given the abducted fishermen, dreamed up by American women office workers at CISO on Okinawa. "Let's give them a yard of cloth, real cheap cloth," they suggested, "about 10 cents worth, with some thread and a needle." Learned PSYOPs experts protested that the cloth could be used to make uniforms. "Not this cloth," the women explained, showing a yellow and red three-stripe psychedelic pattern that resembled South Vietnam's flag. There was just enough cloth to make diapers or a child's shirt, which CISO Deputy Ben Baker found particularly inspired. "Imagine the secret police trying to take a kid's only shirt off his back," he said. "The mother will kill them with a broom." The CISO women also designed a child's ball, its rubber impregnated with South Vietnam's national colors. Ben Baker found it all amusing. "Can you imagine taking them away from kids?" Black propaganda items often were planted in Cambodia and Laos by U.S.-led recon teams, the primary type being soap chips, which were forged letters supposedly from families in North Vietnam to soldiers in the South, hand-planted on NVA bodies or left beside heavily traveled trails. The letters were folded over and over as if read and reread, some soldier's treasured message from home. The themes were clever. For instance, a letter could term a Tet, New Year, dinner, a feast, but describe such minimal fare that the reader could only wonder what food was available back home. In early 1970, shortly after Ho Chi Minh's death, SOG teams inserted fraudulent Happy Tet cards bearing the message, "Best wishes and success," supposedly from a high North Vietnamese official who implied he was Ho's heir apparent, and coming well before the party central committee had selected a successor. The cards seemed a usurper's attempt to wrest power and were intended to doom his chances. SOG also continued a long wartime tradition of damaging an enemy by counterfeiting his money. During World War II, the United States had printed large numbers of German Reichsmarks to fund intelligence operations because the genuine article was hard to obtain. But fearing retaliation, U.S. policy has been to restrict counterfeiting to limited intelligence uses rather than engage in it on a scale intended to wreck an opponent's economy. It wasn't very difficult to forge North Vietnamese paper money, which lacked modern counterfeiting safeguards. Indeed, North Vietnamese currency designers thought there was little likelihood anyone would duplicate their money since, like other communist money, it had no value beyond North Vietnam's borders. In addition, the party stringently controlled internal printing presses, leaving the only real threat from SOG or the CIA. Cutting technically perfect plates and printing North Vietnamese funny money proved a snap for Okinawa-based experts who'd mastered their craft duplicating all sorts of foreign documents and credentials. For those running recon, the top-secret counterfeit currency most often inserted was codenamed Benson Silk, an NVA scrip or kind of occupation money. Mostly it was carried as a secondary rather than a primary mission, with our intelligence officers instructing, "If you get a chance, plant some of this stuff." Benson Silk was tightly controlled, signed out on a hand receipt, and usually carried only by the 10. It was planted mostly to confuse the enemy. A North Vietnamese intelligence officer coming upon a small fortune on a dead NVA soldier would have to ask, how had he acquired all this money? Was he a thief? No. Then he had to be a U.S. agent, and therefore this wasn't an ambush, but a prearranged meeting that went bad. How would the comrades in his squad not have known, unless they too were traitors? And so on. The enemy was meant to chew this over and over and never be quite sure. And insidiously, even if the enemy determined this money was counterfeit, his paranoia was aroused all the more. How much other money was counterfeit, too? Interestingly, Hanoi did not complain publicly about these money games, though certainly its leaders realized SOG was counterfeiting North Vietnamese currency. A defector reported Hanoi could throw no stones because the North Vietnamese were duplicating South Vietnamese money on an even larger scale. But polluting the enemy's currency was as nothing compared to SOG's most successful salting operation, Project Eldest Son, at various times also codenamed Italian Green and later Pole Bean, which insinuated into the enemy's supply system cleverly sabotaged AK-47 and mortar ammunition that blew up in his weapons, killing or wounding his soldiers. The genesis of Eldest Son was in the fertile mind of that old OSS operative chief SOG Colonel Jack Singlob, who explained, "I was frustrated by the fact that I couldn't airlift the ammunition we were discovering along the Ho Chi Minh Trail. A typical cache contained far more ammo than a small team could carry away. It could not be destroyed with fire, and explosives would only scatter small arms ammunition, not damage it." Singlob reports, "Initially I thought of just booby-trapping it so that when they'd pick up a case it would blow up. Some kind of mercury switches or timers would have worked, but it would have been difficult and time-consuming for recon men to open ammo cases and plant booby traps without leaving a trace." At almost the same time, Singlob was wrestling with the problem of ammo caches. A reader's letter in American Rifleman magazine suggested the very solution he came up with: booby-trap the ammunition itself. Singlob had his CIA deputy use agency channels for a quick feasibility study. A short while later, Singlob was invited to Okinawa for a demonstration. A bench-mounted AK-47 was loaded with one Eldest Son round. Then he was invited to pull the string attached to its trigger. He was awed because it completely blew up the receiver and the bolt was projected backward. I would imagine that would be into the head of the firer. It appeared to be very lethal. I was convinced that it was. Each recon team carried a few Eldest Son rounds, usually as loose AK cartridges or a single round in an otherwise normal full AK magazine. These were not so much for inserting in caches as planting on the bodies of ambushed enemy soldiers, which was the least detectable means of insertion. Eldest Son 82mm mortar ammo typically came in heavy crates of four rounds, so teams didn't carry it as often. Still, I recall twice toting such cases during recon operations, and to our surprise, we witnessed an enemy platoon carry one case away. Probably the cleverest Eldest Son insertion was performed by SOG SEALs in a Mekong Delta canal, where they filled a sampan with tainted ammunition, shot it tastefully full of holes, then spilled chicken blood over it and set it adrift upstream from a known Viet Cong village, making it look as though its communist crew had fallen overboard in an ambush. The Viet Cong took it hook, line, and sinker. But the bulk of Eldest Son ammunition was disseminated in other ways, probably the biggest being the construction of false caches in areas known to contain real ones. Special teams were created at SOG Recon FOBs in Da Nang and Ban Nae Thut just to build these false caches. It was while on such a mission that a Da Nang Eldest Son cache-building team was lost on 30 November 1968, generating more Special Forces MIAs than any other SOG cross-border operation. Led by a happy-go-lucky Hawaiian, Major Samuel Toomey, this seven-man, all-U.S. team and a dozen cases of Eldest Son 82mm mortar ammo were aboard a King Bee helicopter 20 miles west of Khe San when a single 37mm anti-aircraft round hit the chopper. The effect was catastrophic. An eyewitness reported, "There wasn't anything bigger than a cigarette butt that hit the ground. It just went off like a nuke." In addition to Toomey, missing were Lieutenant Raymond Stacks and Sergeants Klaus Schultz, Arthur Bader, Richard Fitz, Michael Mine, and Gary LeBon. Beyond human loss, the incident generated a scathing reaction from Vientiane when the U.S. ambassador learned of it. SOG headquarters had tried to slip the operation past him and hadn't sought his approval. The embassy's protest was so strong, recalls Chief SOG Colonel Steve Cavanaugh, that it almost stopped the whole Eldest Son program. But Eldest Son's successes spoke louder and more convincingly than could any parochial argument. And the proof of its effectiveness rolled in. For instance, on 6 June 1968, U.S. 1st Infantry Division soldiers came upon a shattered AK-47 found beside the body of an NVA soldier who'd died while firing at the Americans. It seemed a great mystery to them why his weapon had exploded, since his AK magazine was half empty, suggesting that nothing could have been obstructing the muzzle. Paratroopers of the 101st Airborne Division similarly found a dead communist soldier grasping his exploded rifle, while Captain Ed Lassane reports seeing a photo at SOG headquarters of a dead enemy soldier with his AK's bolt blown out the back of his weapon and right through his eye socket. SOG's booby-trapped mortar rounds proved effective, too. American 25th Infantry Division soldiers discovered a whole North Vietnamese mortar battery destroyed, with dead gunners sprawled around four peeled-back tubes. In another incident, a 101st Airborne Division firebase was taking mortar fire one night, when there was an odd-sounding boomf from a facing hillside, after which firing abruptly stopped. A sweep the next morning revealed two dead enemy soldiers, a split tube, and blood trails going off into the jungle. Eldest Son ammo was getting into enemy hands. And as the reports came in, SOG initiated the program's next phase, its black PSYOP exploitation. One Viet Cong document, forged by SOG, of course, and insinuated through secret agents to the Viet Cong's National Liberation Front, NLF, tried to make light of exploding weapons, declaring, "We know that it is rumored that some of the ammunition has blown up in the AK-47. This report is greatly exaggerated. It is a very, very small percentage of the ammunition that has exploded." And through Eldest Son, SOG was tossing salt in that Chinese relations wound, attributing the faulty ammunition to Red Chinese sources. "Only a few thousand such cases have been found thus far," was the theme of a number of forged North Vietnamese documents, as quoted by a senior SOG officer. One forgery concluded that while our allies, the People's Republic of China, may be having some quality control problems, these are being worked out, and we think that in the future there will be very little chance of this happening. That "in the future" hook was especially devious, because any NVA soldier looking at the lot numbers on his ammo cases could see all of it had been manufactured years earlier, and due to the natural lag of shipping from China and transporting it down the trail, no really new ammo could possibly reach NVA combat soldiers for a long, long time. Eldest Son impacted at enemy command levels, too, Colonel Cavanaugh reported. "We had communications, intercept evidence anyway, that that thing, Eldest Son, was worth its weight, because warnings were issued throughout the NVA to be careful of this and do that and this." The enemy actually thought it was a manufacturing problem, not sabotage. To make sure the word got out, not just to the enemy but also as a warning to American soldiers, SOG arranged for cautionary notices on armed forces radio and TV. But the concerns about endangering U.S. personnel were no deception. MACV issued Directive 381-24, which forbade the employment of captured weapons and munitions other than by special mission personnel. News reached the weekly civilian stateside tabloid Army Times, which warned GIs in August 1969 that numerous incidents have caused injury and sometimes death to the operators of enemy weapons, the cause of which was defective metallurgy or faulty ammo. Inevitably, the enemy realized that something was happening to his ammunition, but This was still psychologically useful since it caused him to fear any ammo cache that the U.S. recon teams had found. Word about Eldest's son was leaking out so extensively by mid-1969 that Time magazine reported, "Special forces have been accused of slipping doctored ammunition designed to explode on use into enemy caches." Sogman chuckled at such naivete since Time thought this illegal and the work of rogues. Related to Eldest's son were a few specially built booby-trapped items SOG teams inserted in Laos, not for their destructive effect, but to inspire certain enemy reactions. For example, recon teams left behind booby-trapped 35mm cameras, so enemy soldiers would find them and pass them along to their intelligence officers. When opened, of course, they blew up. The least suspicious booby trap I ever handled was an Okinawa-built one-quart canteen that even contained a liquid you could hear sloshing if you shook it. Under the cap was a time delay activation switch. Once the switch was flicked, the next time the cap was unscrewed, kapow. Like the camera, it was intended to deter the enemy from stripping gear off recon men's bodies. To deter the enemy from using captured American radios, CISO manufactured special booby trap kits for PRC 25 FM sets, the standard type carried by U.S. and ARVN units, as well as SOG recon teams. These were packed with plastic explosive and a detonator that went off when the radio was switched on. Bob Howard, one of SOG's most accomplished recon men and a Medal of Honor recipient, came up with his own technique to instill a bit of caution in enemy soldiers posted to watch landing zones in Laos. He took an old footlocker and painted it bright red. Then he packed it with about 80 pounds of aging TNT that was starting to sweat nitro. Duel primed it with 5-minute time delay detonators and left it on his insert LZ. He led his team off into the jungle, then circled back to watch what happened. "Sure enough," he said, "people were coming from everywhere, running out to get that footlocker. And I actually think some of them were in the process of opening it when it went off. I mean, that bastard blew a hole in the ground. It blew shit for a quarter of a mile. That's how much TNT we had in it." Probably the most elaborate dirty trick was the brainchild of Sergeant Major Paul Darcy, who scrounged an unflyable 2-seat U-17 spotter plane, then rigged it with smoke grenades, and had a helicopter carry it over southern Laos one overcast morning. Darcy and another man played a radio game, simulating messages from a stricken plane until finally came a panicky voice, "He's going down! He's going down!" Darcy ignited the smoke grenades, then the helicopter released the old aircraft, which fell through the clouds, streaming smoke, and crashed in the jungle. Eventually, the enemy reached the wreckage, found the smoke grenades, and realized he'd been had. But when the next real plane went down, perhaps he wouldn't respond quite so fast, which would improve chances of a bright light team getting there first. But the most mind-blowing dirty trick I ever saw was conceived by my good recon friend Floyd Pigpen Ambrose. He went all the way to Bangkok to have printed a poster of his own design, showing a nude, large-breasted Asian woman, which he'd tack on trees beside major enemy trails. Imagine the shock of an NVA soldier, raised under a straight-laced communist orthodoxy that prohibited pornography, who came upon Floyd's poster, not to mention the provocative headline which boldly asked in Vietnamese, "Who's sleeping with your wife? And has she got jugs like these?" As the message grew more inflammatory, the print became smaller, luring the engrossed soldier closer and closer, and he'd forget caution and step right on the small mine Floyd had planted and lose a foot. Due to these and other SOG black psyop tricks, one can hardly wonder at the confused reports that float up and down the enemy chain of command, and the fevered attempts to reassure everyone that headquarters was on top of it. Could the NVA publish a bulletin to beware of red boxes left in the open? They might as well have issued a bulletin: "Beware of everything." Though the exact effects remain unmeasurable, there can be little doubt that SOG's black propaganda yielded results. The closest SOG ever came to learning its impact was in Paris in May 1968. As a precondition to peace talks, Hanoi's negotiators insisted that the U.S. put an end to its black psyops programs, especially that despicable Sacred Sword of the Patriot League. 8. Run Through the Jungle. By late 1967, nearly every other SOG cross-border mission made contact, with about half the contents leading to live-or-die shootouts against vastly more numerous enemy. NVA forces in Laos and Cambodia had climbed above 100,000, with 40,000 of them detailed as Ho Chi Minh Trail security. Another 100,000 NVA passed down the trail that year en route to South Vietnam. Against these enormous numbers, SOG typically fielded 30 or 40 Americans at once in Laos and Cambodia. Major Ed Ribot, SOG's FOB-1 commander at Phu Bai in 1967-68, recalls the stress. "I was almost getting nightmares. Every time we went in, ba-ba-ba-ba-boom, crack, bang. FOB-1 took a hell of a plastering during my time up there. We took 51 or 52% casualties on operations." At least half the time, though, SOG teams successfully penetrated enemy redoubts to wiretap, ambush, kidnap, mine, and surveil the North Vietnamese, and fought their way out despite abysmal odds. How? Take the case of R.T. Main's adventure in southeast Laos. It was late morning when R.T. Main's H-34 Kingbee dodged drifting rain squalls to land on a slash-and-burn clearing about 15 miles inside Laos near Highway 165. Additional troop helicopters, gunships, and A-1 Sky Raiders hung back just beyond earshot, ready to intervene in case of trouble. 1-0 David Baker was first man off the Kingbee, followed by Mike Buckland, his 1-2, with the radio. Then the 1-1, Sherman Miller, and 5 Montagnards, the Kingbee lifted away. Baker headed for a woodline, then froze. Everyone froze. Just ahead were bunkers and milling groups of NVA. Baker backed away, turned for another woodline, and saw it too bristling with men and heavy earth and log bunkers. NVA soldiers were everywhere. R.T. Main was totally surrounded on an open LZ, outnumbered perhaps 20-1 by an entrenched enemy, overlooked by heavy machine guns whose bolts they now heard slamming shut. By any reckoning, Baker and his 7 men had about 10 seconds to live. Buckland tersely radioed Covey, "Have inserted into a major unit and not yet engaged. Stand by." But the NVA just stood there, watching, some only 20 yards away. Baker made a shrewd observation. The NVA had bomb shelters, not fighting bunkers. These lacked firing ports, so the NVA couldn't shoot from inside and had to climb out even to see, silhouetting their heads and shoulders like targets in a shooting gallery. Meanwhile, a half dozen enemy leaders marched from deeper in the bunker area with an indignant, "We'll get to the bottom of this," air about them. Perhaps, just perhaps, R.T. Main's unmarked Kingbee had been mistaken for a similar-looking Soviet-made MI-4 used by the North Vietnamese. 1-2, Mike Buckland smiled, waved, and called out reassuringly in Russian. More NVA were standing atop bunkers now, craning necks like gawkers at a traffic accident. They didn't even point their AKs at the team. Baker, Buckland, and their yard point man kept their Kar-15s low and let the NVA officers approach to the edge of the woodline, only 15 paces away. Then all three opened fire and snuffed them in 2 seconds. The NVA command element was gone. Stunned, NVA machine gunners grabbed their heavy 12.7mm guns but did not fire, unable to believe what had happened. That's where they died. Shot down by the fast-firing recon men. So astounded were the NVA that the SOG men fired a full 10 seconds before the enemy shot back, but then it turned into a melee. More NVA climbed into view, and R.T. Main cleaned the bunker tops again, this time dropping 20 men. But their luck was almost gone. Seeking cover, Baker hustled his men a few steps into a knee-deep depression, just enough to lie belly down in while heavy fire crisscrossed above them. Astonishingly, the NVA began shooting at each other. Hugging terra firma, the SOG men shot low to ensure hits while the confused NVA fired high, hitting each other. Newly arriving NVA didn't understand at whom or what they were supposed to fire. Baker called in gunships and told them to strafe any tree line. Manned by replacements, the two 12.7mm fired, but they'd been emplaced as anti-aircraft weapons and their muzzles couldn't be depressed low enough to hit RT main. They were pummeling their own bunkers. A pair of A-1 Sky Raiders rolled in with cluster bombs and 20mm cannons just as an NVA squad assaulted the SOG team. The NVA were dead before they'd gone 10 yards. On a shouted command, another NVA squad rushed out but made it only 20 yards before Car 15 fire knocked them all down. Covey offered to attempt an extract, but Baker said no, not until the NVA were dead or pushed back. Fire was coming closer now. Bullets smacked into the rucksacks behind which Maine's men had taken shelter. Then a bullet tore a URC-10 radio from Baker's hand. The NVA launched 3 human wave assaults, and each time they got closer before Maine's fire cut them down. Baker told Covey to bring napalm in closer, they'd be overrun. Another 15 NVA jumped to their feet, shouting and dashing and firing just as an A-1 rolled in. Then a bouncing 750-pound napalm canister split apart so close it spewed petroleum-smelling globs on RT Main's rucksacks and weapons and on Mike Buckland's hands and shirt. An instant later, the napalm burst hot orange all around them and set ablaze rucksacks and a Montagnard's Car 15. They felt the air sucked away as black smoke blocked the sun, and inside its shadow, 15 Vietnamese human torches staggered and collapsed. A horrifying sight, Buckland called it. The napalm globs on RT Main's men did not ignite. Buckland recalled a verse from Isaiah, "When you walk through fire, you shall not be burned." The Sky Raiders had knocked out the heavy machine guns, and at last, bloodied and burned, the NVA fell back. A King Bee, nearly out of station time, snatched away RT Main. Baker's men had been on the ground 42 minutes and had fired nearly 4,000 rounds and had thrown 50 grenades. They'd been too busy fighting to count, but likely 50 enemy lay dead and twice that many wounded. Against this heavy loss, Baker alone was wounded, superficially, by grenade fragments. What's significant in RT Main's encounter is not that they were lucky, but that luck's contribution was secondary. The wads often seemed dismal, as in Maine's case. It was the 1-0's job to turn the odds around through shrewd judgment and tactical skill. Realistic training, mastery of weapons, and understanding the enemy were the bedrock that made this possible. It began with solid mission planning. Contrary to how Hollywood depicts such things, a SOG operation was not laid out in a 30-second huddle aboard an aircraft en route to a target. The process began a week before insert with a warning order that gave the 1-0 an execution date, target, and mission description. Later, the team's Americans sat through a formal briefing. Then the 1-0 overflew the target to select LZs, shoot photos, and get the lay of the land. Next came days studying maps, intelligence reports, and aerial photos. Then the 1-0 formulated a detailed plan that he briefed back to his FOB commander. The 1-0 had tremendous latitude, a freer hand, thought Major Henry Goel, a SOG staff officer, than most senior officers in conventional forces. And there was pre-mission training. If it was a wiretap, for instance, the team brushed up on operating tap gear and rehearsed security formations they'd use during the tap. Finally came the draw of mission-specific gear, packing it all up, followed by the 1-0's equipment inspection, then a quick weapons test firing. Every aspect of SOG recon procedures was intensely thought through to push out little edges, 1,000 little edges that cumulatively yielded the kind of decisive advantage that brought RT Main out alive. Recon men had to outrun, outshoot, outmaneuver, and outthink the best Hanoi threw at them. Mastery of weapons was the starting point. Chief SOG Colonel Jack Singlob said, It is my view that a guy who has 100% confidence in his ability to use his or any weapon doesn't have to worry about his personal safety. He can concentrate on his mission. Applying Colonel Singlob's observation, SOG men practice fired at least every other day. After firing a Kar 15 extensively, its three-round bursts seemed to dance from its muzzle. You hit targets by not aiming but by thinking about aiming. Reflexes became so blazingly fast that the act preceded the thought. I once drew, shot, and dropped an NVA faster than I could recognize him, and only afterward did I realize that he already had his AK trained on me when I drew. But a recon man required presence of mind. RT California 10 Joe Walker once had an NVA let loose full auto just 30 yards away. Joe instantly fired back at full auto, but didn't connect in two bursts, so he knelt, flipped to semi-auto, aimed, in a flurry of flying lead, and dropped the NVA with one shot. Most men would have sprayed and prayed. Every item a recon man carried was deliberately positioned. Reload magazines went on his left side, grenades on the right, compass on the left wrist so he could extend his arm away from a steel weapon for an accurate reading without taking his right hand off the grip. Reload magazines were positioned so even on the move he could drop an empty magazine with one hand, pull a full one with the other, slam it into his Kar 15 without even looking, slap the bolt release with the left palm and continue firing. With practice, reloading took less than 3 seconds. Recon men straightened grenade pins and wrapped them once with tape, so that even if wounded in one arm, they could pull pins with their teeth, just like in the movies. And every bit of gear was muffled with tape or rubber bands, so it generated no rattle or clank or noise of any kind. There was a rule, a lesson, a reason for everything they did. Everything. SOG's top-secret world evolved its own ethic, an unspoken code tempered by danger, duty, and loyalty. The 10 was the most knowledgeable and experienced man on the team. Even if outranked by his 1-1 or 1-2, the 10 was God. When he declared his team had to be extracted, his judgment was not usually questioned. As Major Scotty Creerar observed, "If he's wrong, if we find out he's lost his nerve, we'll change him. But don't second-guess him from here." The 10 was the first man off the helicopter going in, and the last man on coming out. If a point man was overwhelmed by fear, the 10 walked point himself. He led not by force of rank or intimidation, but by example. Indeed, a SOG team was a free association of volunteers who chose to serve together. Medal of Honor recipient Bob Howard explained, "It's kind of hard to put into words, but it's like having somebody that you love. If you served in SOG and you were willing to die, you wanted to have a person there you would not mind dying for or dying with. A lot of people don't understand that." There was great assurance in looking over, narrow-eyed and tense, your thumb easing the Kar 15 safety off, to see your partner's eyes just the same, both knowing that no matter the fury about to be unleashed, he would not run off and leave you, nor would you leave him. That's not cheap talk. When 10 times as many NVA as anyone should reasonably fight suddenly appear, eons of evolution and every bit of common sense screams, "Run!" Afraid? Beyond words. But you stay and fight. Leaving behind a live, wounded man was all but inconceivable, but teammates forced each other to vow not to risk their lives for their dead bodies. Yes, SOG teams left American bodies if they had to. Better that than give their foes more lives. To give such an order, and I've given the command myself, leaves no remorse, just regret at its necessity. SOG survivors always felt they carried their teammates' spirit back with them. Devotion to mission was an ethic, too. A recon man's duty was to accomplish his mission and survive in that order. Those who operated well in SOG's environment earned the highest compliment. "He's good in the woods." When 10s talked among themselves, their highest assessment was, "I'd take him on the ground with me." Like notches on the butt of a 6-gun, The SOG man's cross-border missions measured merit. Until he had 3 missions, he shouldn't open his mouth. After 5 missions, he could be relied upon to tell a war story honestly. 10 made him seasoned and probably a 1-0. 15 and he was running out of luck. 20. And it was hard to explain why he was still alive. Based upon the military logic that your best men handled the most difficult tasks, mission success earned you a more dangerous assignment next time. Until, as 1-0 Squirrel Sprouse used to say, "We're being run to death." Often that's where it led. In RT Hawaii's case, their nemesis became Target Juliet 9, the most hostile piece of real estate in southern Laos. 1-0 Bill De Lima and teammates Glenn Uemura and Lonnie Pulliam barely escaped their first time in Juliet 9, but their 1-1, First Lieutenant Jim Ripanti, was killed. A few months later, Juliet 9 again was the scheduled target, and since they knew the area, Uemura as acting 1-0 and De Lima got the mission, bringing along Ripanti's replacement, Specialist 4 Dennis Bingham. Hit by a reinforced company, Uemura and De Lima barely made it out, and this time bloody Juliet 9 took young Bingham's life. Not long afterward, Bill De Lima declared his willingness to go any place but Juliet 9, and insisted he could not go back into that hellhole. Yet even as he spoke, he knew he'd go, if assigned. Recon men always did. 1-0 Ken McMillan recalls, "You'd absolutely not want to run that mission, not at all. Scared to death. But I'd rather die than have my friends think I was chicken shit." But SOG's behind-the-lines domain was not every man's cup of tea. Sergeant First Class Sammy Hernandez had a recon man weep on his shoulder after a narrow escape, begging not to go back into Laos. The man quit. When I saw him at Fort Bragg years later at the bar, he always put his head down when he saw me come in, says Hernandez. I told him, "Hey, buddy, you don't have to do that. You have nothing to be ashamed of. Some people can do it. Some people can't. I am never going to be the guy to say, 'Hey, you don't have the guts to go out on those patrols.' You'll never hear that from me." Explains Captain Jim Storter, "There are some people that once they hear the helicopters go off in the distance, their ass gets so tight that they can't breathe. When it gets quiet and you're on your own, a lot of people can't handle it." Adds the Khon-Thum FOB commander, Lieutenant Colonel Galen Mike Radke, "You can't train a man for that. He's got to be born into that." Like Ben Lyons, who explained, "I just got a charge out of being in the other guy's backyard." A few long-time recon men couldn't quit if they wanted to. Like compulsive gamblers, they'd so often wagered their lives that anything else became hopelessly boring. We called it getting recon in your blood, a danger-induced adrenaline rush that inspired ever greater risks. The more missions you accumulated, the harder it was to stop. Eventually, most such men wagered once too often. Everyone respected the dangers. That's why they trained so hard, why they finessed tactics. The basic tactic for bettering a numerically superior foe was immediate action, IA drills, which worked something like a bantamweight boxer bloodying a heavyweight's nose with a surprise flurry of punches, then exploiting the subsequent 10 seconds of amazement to head for the hills. IA drills were carefully orchestrated, rehearsed, then mastered. An IA drill trigger was one shot, usually fired by the point man, though even if the enemy fired first, the drill was executed the same way. Odd-numbered men jumped one step right, even men one step left, and faced the direction of fire, whether hit from back, front, or side. The man closest emptied his weapon full auto at the enemy in 3-round bursts, then dashed between his arrayed comrades to lead the team away in the opposite direction. The split second the first man's weapon was empty, the next man picked up the slack, also firing full auto. Then he too ran down the middle, after the first man. And so on. To exaggerate a team's firepower, they fired only tracer rounds in their first magazine. The result was one long continuous burst backed up by exploding 40mm projectiles, tear gas, and white phosphorus grenades, then a 1-minute time delay claymore planted by the last man. from first shot to last was 30 seconds or less, a shocking blur of bullets and explosions that seemed 10 times the fury possible for a mere 6 or 8 men to unleash. Between operations, recon teams rehearsed live-fire IA drills several times per week. SOG men constantly looked for new devices or techniques to enhance IA drills. While I was 1-0 of RT California, it occurred to me that a bugle sounding a charge would unnerve the NVA. But I couldn't find a bugle, nor anyone who could be relied upon to pucker amid a firefight. Then I recalled the Freon-powered air horns at high school football games. Perfect. My father shipped me an air horn, which I spray-painted black and carried into Cambodia, taped to my web gear. On our second day in Daniel Boone, Rex Jaco, John Yancey, Galen Musselman, and I walked into an L-shaped ambush by about 20 NVA firing AKs, machine guns, and rockets. We squatted down and returned fire, but we were almost pinned. I reached for a grenade, but my hand found the air horn. I depressed its plunger for a full 15 seconds. Ah! Ooh. When I lifted my finger, you could hear a pin drop. The NVA had run away. We escaped from what could have been doom without a scratch. But tricks like that work only the first time. No force, no matter its size or armament, stood a chance against SOG IA drills for 30 seconds. After that, no matter how slick your IA drill, God found himself on the side of the big battalions. A competent 1-0 anticipated enemy contact and mentally rehearsed his reactions, continually revising his thoughts to fit shifting circumstances. If we're hit right now, where's the nearest LZ? What do I do if we take fire from uphill versus downhill, or at our same elevation? Should we fight through or flee? If there's a trail atop this hill, are we far enough below the crest that passing NVA won't hear us? Where's the nearest defensible terrain? Where's our next rally point in case we're split? Upon contact, the team would be executing their 1-0's plan while the enemy was only reacting. Preferably, though, SOG teams practiced such stealth that there was no contact. In a full day, a team often advanced only 500 yards. That's only 50 yards per hour, which translates to just one step per minute. During that minute, you scanned front and sides, carefully eyeballed any place an enemy soldier might lurk, trained your Car 15 at the spot where contact might erupt, examined the ground where you'd next place your foot, paused, smelled, listened, delicately pushed aside a vine with your left hand, tested the ground ahead with one toe, slowly shifted your weight to the forward foot, eased the vine behind you, and ensured it didn't catch on your rucksack or web gear. Paused. Listened. Looked around again. Lifted your trailing foot and gently brought it up to your other foot. You repeated this process, hour after hour, exactly. He became immersed in tiny, deliberate actions, patient acts that so occupied your mind that there was nothing but the present, this step, this minute, this place. Consciousness soared. Silence was not a virtue. It was the virtue. If a yard or American snapped the tiniest twig, his teammates' glaring eyes damned him for endangering the rest. A few such infractions and the perpetrator was off the team. Camouflage was simple but effective. Just before an operation, each man put on his field gear, rucksack, web gear, hat, scarf, weapon, over unmarked, sterile jungle fatigues. Teammates took turns spray-painting each other with black streaks to tone down the edges and blend it all together. For their shadowy world of deep jungle, stepping from shadow to shadow, this camouflage pattern fit in superbly. They applied camouflage stick to their faces and touched it up hourly during breaks. Some men took it one step further and dyed their blonde hair black. During a 5-day mission, they spoke only in whispers, but most often they communicated by hand signals, facial expressions, and body language. A nod, a click of the tongue, a raised eyebrow, a shrug, tipping or shaking or nodding the head, an inquiring glance. Your Montagnard point man freezes, one foot suspended mid-step, his left hand signs VC, and he eases that foot to earth. He turns slowly, gives you his 1-0, a smile like Sylvester the Cat espying Tweety Bird, meaning the enemy is lax, few in number, and vulnerable. And his wide, happy, feline eyes look to you for the nod to eat, Tweety Bird. And then there was instinct. Modern life so celebrates intellect that we ignore instinct. But when recon men felt something, danger, anticipation, anxiety, hackles rising on their neck, they thought it a subconscious warning. Some hints might be too oblique to be articulated, but were to be considered real nonetheless. It could be the gut feeling that someone's watching you, or an overwhelming foreboding about climbing a hill. Recon men learned to trust their instincts. It was instinct and woodsman skills that saved the day for RT Illinois. After evading trackers and an aggressive NVA platoon for 2 days, deep in Laos, 1-0 Steve Kiever paused for a break on a hill beside his 1-1 Larry Predmore and 1-2 Dan Ross. "Pretty soon Larry Predmore taps my leg and he points downhill," Kiever recalled. Being the knowledgeable outdoors person that he is, he sees an owl come out of a tree and fly up the hill toward us a little bit, alight in another tree, and turn around and look. A longtime Minnesota hunter, Predmore knew owls don't take wing in daytime unless disturbed, and by no coincidence, this owl had been flushed from their back trail. Predmore had a bad feeling about it. Signaling the others to be still, he raised his car 15, and his front sight met the curious face of an NVA tracker who looked up to his doom. The 1-1 dropped him and several other NVA. Illinois executed an IA drill, then they ran for it. Between Predmore, the IA drill, and tactical airstrikes, they accounted easily for a dozen NVA, while RT Illinois suffered not one minor wound. A wise 1-0 assumed from the moment he landed that the enemy was scouring for any sign of his team, and therefore he tried to eliminate evidence of their passage, a process called sterilizing. It was the assistant team leader's job to sterilize their back trail, picking up flotsam, intertwining foliage and obscuring footprints. Some RTs became fatally lax. 2 overrun teams were found by bright light teams simply by following candy wrappers and cigarette butts from their insert LZs to the places they died. Or, it can be said, to the places the NVA so easily slaughtered them. Yet even after careful sterilizing, creating false trails, and deftly changing directions, teams still sometimes picked up trackers. Then the basic counterattack was button-hooking, circling back to observe your own back trail. Or you could leave mines. Mining a back trail was easy using the M14 toe popper, a mine that was the diameter of a soda can but only 1/3 as long and weighing less than 1/4 pound. Designed to injure 1 foot, hence its nickname, the toe popper was compact and carried by the dozen. Toe poppers were great for alerting you to shadowers, as RT West Virginia found during one mission. While slogging through thick jungle, 1-0 Ron Knight noticed his nungs had to sit atop a wide mahogany log, then pivot their legs over to cross it. Knight wedged a toe popper under the bark, right where they'd crossed. "And we probably hadn't gone 30 or 40 meters when I heard that boy pop, and you never heard such screaming. So we got somebody." Another counter-tactic was more direct, though riskier. Ambush the trackers with a suppressed weapon. It works fine in the movies, but if the enemy gets off even one shot, it discloses your location to nearby enemy forces, and the race is on. 1-0 Richard Gross had evaded NVA for several days in the heavily occupied Ashaw Valley, when one morning he spotted a tracker a few yards below him in a gully. So preoccupied, studying the ground, that his M1 carbine was slung over his shoulder. "He's looking right and left," Gross said. Gross began unholstering his silenced .22 high-standard pistol. Then the tracker looked up and made eye contact. "And he grabbed that damn carbine, and I had my car 15 lying right there, picked it up and boom. Had to. Didn't have any other choice. Gross hoped the tracker was alone, but several NVA platoons arrived, and a long firefight ensued. Fortunately, Gross lived to tell the tale. Doing the unexpected also could shake pursuers. With trackers close behind, 10 Joe Walker and RT California reached a major highway. To lose the trackers, Walker did the unthinkable. At high noon, he trotted 2 kilometers down Highway 110. It was Pok time, the Vietnamese equivalent of siesta, and they came upon not a single NVA. The trackers couldn't find a track on that hard-packed clay surface, and besides, they knew no Americans would go down the road. Dog-assisted tracker teams proved tougher to counter, but the handlers often relied too heavily on their furry friends to alert them to danger. In Cambodia, Ben Lyon's recon team had an oddly ironic tracker dog encounter. Out of water, his team crept to a creek and spotted a handful of approaching enemy. Lyon's men lay low. The NVA had a dog which began barking. "I could hear an NVA talking, didn't understand what he was saying," Lyons said. Then one communist soldier almost stepped on Lyons' yard point man, who opened fire, cutting down the dog and several NVA. After the mission, Lyons asked his point man what the dog handler had said just before he shot him. The Montagnard chuckled and reported, "He say, 'Don't worry, dog. I know Americans are near.'" Lyons shook his head. And that's the last thing that sucker said. After experimenting with various concoctions to confuse tracker dogs, red pepper, exotic fragrances, SOG settled on CS tear gas powder, which teams carried in plastic bottles and shook out like talcum powder. John Meyer, 10 of RT Idaho, had to employ every trick in the book to escape NVA hot in his trail in Target Echo 8, a particularly dangerous place just west of the Ashaw Valley. He had just set up an ambush on Highway 922 when a tow popper on his back trail exploded. Seconds later, 2 heavy diesel engines started up, and tracked vehicles rolled out of a base camp a half mile away. "Then things got real hairy," Meyer said. A reinforced NVA platoon came down the highway, alert, eyes scouring the bushes as the 2 tracked vehicles swept back and forth through the thin brush. Then RT Idaho heard a dog barking behind them. In full daylight, Meyer risked everything to dash his men across the road, then headed into deep jungle to find a place to hide overnight. Again he heard that damned dog. His 1-1 laced their back trail with CS powder. Then they heard another dog, this one nearer, on their left flank. RT Idaho waded quietly along a stream, emerged and scattered more CS powder, then went back in the stream, continuing to move long after dark. They heard a dog howl when it got a good whiff of CS powder. Finally, they climbed a steep bank and set up a perimeter. Meyer's point man climbed a tree and in the darkness could make out dozens of flashlights scouring the stream banks and back trail, but RT Idaho was safe. "Going back through that stream saved us," Meyer decided. Because trackers would come running when distinct American boot prints were discovered, SOG devoted considerable effort to disguising boot soles. The CIA research and development technicians at Camp Chinen, Okinawa, came up with the cleverest solution, boots with human barefoot soles. But when tested, the heelless boots couldn't grip. They lost authenticity with wear, and besides, they were uncomfortable. A great idea that didn't pan out. The next brainstorm was to replace Vibram soles with tire treads to resemble Ho Chi Minh sandals. But many NVA by then were wearing sneaker-like Bata boots, which had their own distinct pattern. CISO acquired Bata boots in Hong Kong, and some teams wore them despite the boots' weak arches and reduced ankle support. Many SOG teams wore portions of enemy uniforms to confuse the NVA and gain a few seconds advantage during a chance contact. For instance, CSS 10 Bob Graham's entire team wore NVA pith helmets. Many 10s attired their Indig point man in NVA uniform, complete with chest-style web gear and AK-47. Some teams went whole hog, outfitting themselves entirely in NVA clothes, weapons, and gear, despite the fact that the law of land warfare sanctions executing disguised men. The advantage was significant. Anyone a SOG team encountered was a bad guy, while the enemy had to figure out just who you were. 10 Ron Knight's NVA-uniformed RT West Virginia once inadvertently walked right into an ambush, but an uncertain NVA called A.B. Doe. Who goes there? This was followed by another shout on Knight's flank, Americans! Americans! But Knight and his 1-1, Larry Kramer, were already firing and shot their way out of it. But I'm convinced, Knight said, if we hadn't been in those NVA uniforms, it would have been all over for us. Ron Knight also experienced the flip side of mistaken identities. After a tough afternoon of ground assaults and gunship duels against 12.7mm machine guns, a Huey managed to brave the fire and land. RT West Virginia piled on, but they didn't go anywhere. Knight hollered to the door gunner, "What are you waiting for?" He replied, "You've still got some people out there," and pointed to several men dressed identically to Knight's men, trotting toward the Huey. "Fire 'em up," Knight screamed, and both shot furiously, allowing the Huey to escape the approaching NVA. Like uniforms, team armament was wholly a 10's call. SOG stocked about 40 different kinds of U.S. and foreign weapons. Team leaders strolled into supply and simply fit firearms to any task. The atmosphere was casual. Many teams amassed their own arsenals, with the average about 3 guns per man. But some men acquired over a dozen apiece, everything from belt-fed machine guns and rocket launchers to snub-nosed revolvers. One weapon unique to SOG Recon was the sawed-off Chinese RPD machine gun. Chopping off the RPD's bipod and barrel at the gas port reduced its length to just 32 inches and cut its weight to only 12 pounds, while shifting its center of balance to the drum magazine. The drums were modified to hold 125 rounds rather than 100, every other one a tracer, and a circular slice of linoleum was inserted to eliminate rattle. The SOG RPD was compact, balanced, lightweight, and so controllable you could almost write your name with it. It was superb. Some teams, such as RT New York under Ed Wolkoff and RT California under Joe Walker, carried 2 RPDs, plus Soviet RPG anti-tank rocket launchers, rifle grenades, even a 60mm mortar, quadruple the firepower of a conventional unit this small. Plus, the SOG teams integrated these heavy weapons into IA drills. Another item unique to SOG was the golf ball-sized Dutch V-40 grenade, called Mini Grenade. Each weighed just 3.5 ounces, yet spewed 400-plus fragments. It could be thrown a long, long way, and 10 could be carried in a single shirt pocket. Recon men carried any number of odd weapons, from sawed-off shotguns to flail-like Okinawan nunchakus. 10 Ed Wolkoff armed himself with a meat cleaver, no kidding, whose blade he thought would mesmerize an enemy soldier, giving Ed a slight edge. Although he brought the cleaver to the field, his theory was never tested. I'm convinced that had the Indiana Jones movies existed back then, some recon man would have worn a fedora and packed a bullwhip to crack at the NVA in Laos. But the reward for the most peculiar weapon actually employed has to go to CCS 10 Robert Graham, who'd experimented with Montagnard crossbows, but found them underpowered. He told his yards on RT Pick about the quality bows made in his native Canada. So on a whim, he had a friend of his father's ship a 55-pound bow from Simpsons, the Canadian branch of Sears. A veteran bow hunter, Graham tipped his arrows with razor-edged broadheads. He trained the bow until he could consistently hit a 6-inch circle at 25 paces. Then, his team was slated for a prisoner snatch mission near the enemy's suspected field command headquarters, Kosvin, in Cambodia's Fishhook. Just for safety's sake, he also carried a sawed-off M1 carbine. Inserting with Sergeant Mike Crimmings, another crazy Canadian, according to Graham, Staff Sergeant Frank Oppel, a new lieutenant, and two Montagnards, they soon found a perfect ambush site. But before they were ready, some NVA stumbled into them. Shooting erupted, and they had to rush back to their LZ. Pinned in a bomb crater, they soon found themselves practically out of ammo, and Graham became frustrated, then angered at their predicament. AKs kept cracking rounds over their heads as the NVA maneuvered into position. Finally, Graham had had enough and jumped up with his bow. I yelled as loud as I could and fired exactly where the flashes were coming, and got back down again. Then Graham looked around wide-eyed at his teammates, amazed at himself, and even more amazed because the firing had stopped. He flung a few more broad-headed arrows, then a Green Hornet Huey arrived to extract RT pick. Graham is humorously philosophical about it. I'm sure there's a bunch of guys sitting around the bar up in Hanoi today, and they're all saying, "Yeah, you think you got one. I was out there one time, and I had this guy yell, jump up, and fire an arrow at me." No, no, really. Though they didn't go as far as using bows and arrows, SOG air crews experimented and modified too, adapting their weapons to fit this unique fighting environment. For instance, Sergeant Charlie Dodge, a Huey crew chief, reports he and his fellow 57th Assault Helicopter Company gunners squeezed another 100 rounds per minute out of their machine guns by inserting a second recoil spring. "I'm sure the armorer would probably tell you that it won't work, but it worked great," Dodge said. From cannibalized guns and scrounged parts, the 57th men custom-built their own M60s, replacing the bulky buttstock with a simple plastic cap and attaching an infantry-type pistol grip for a much more compact, easy-to-wield gun. An ordinary sea ration can was modified to replace the feeder ramp, which, combined with a heavier feeder spring, allowed them to connect 70 belts for 7,000 rounds per gun, one awesome amount of firepower. One source of unending pride to crew chiefs and gunners, a big morale builder, was their authority to use free guns, that is, M60 machine guns free of any pintle mount, just hanging from an overhead strap, which enabled them to engage faster with deadlier fire, although this created a danger of losing control of a gun and hitting one's own aircraft or crew. "It was a kind of sign of your competence, and we were really proud of it," Dodge said. Aircraft tactics and insert techniques were developed too, some quite elaborate. For instance, SOG teams inserted on tiny LZs seemingly too small to handle a helicopter, which made it unlikely enemy LZ watchers or tracker teams covered them. Some teams were inserted by flip-flop, that is, pulling a team at the end of its 5-day mission and simultaneously landing a fresh team on the same LZ. The new team would lie low for a few hours, then sneak away. One variation on this was a stay-behind, with a recon team accompanying a hatchet force for several days, going into hiding when the hatchet force lifted away, then creeping off for its own recon mission. Sometimes helicopters would fake an insert on a nearby LZ to draw the enemy away from the real LZ while a team landed there. Such dummy landings weren't attempted often, however, since fake inserts were as dangerous to crews and aircraft as real ones. But SOG's cleverest diversionary tool was an airdropped firefight simulator called the Nightingale device. Named after the bird whose song captivated Chinese emperors, the Nightingale was a CIA product reminiscent of the papier-mâché paratrooper dummies rigged with firecrackers and dropped over Normandy on D-Day. Mounted on a 4x3-foot mesh screen, the Nightingale had powder trails leading to clusters of firecrackers and cherry bombs, which mimicked the peaks and pauses of a real firefight lasting about 10 minutes. Add an acid delay pencil to its igniter, and the Nightingale could go off several hours or several days after emplacement. It was used mostly for false inserts, but there were other uses. Medal of Honor recipient Bob Howard used a Nightingale one night for perhaps the most astonishing firefight of the war. His team had shattered an NVA battalion along Laotian Highway 110, then watched from a hilltop while the enemy set up a night encampment. A lucrative target, but Low overcast precluded a tactical airstrike. Then Howard's assistant team leader, Robert Buckwheat Clough, held up two Nightingales he'd tied to his rucksack for faking an extract, which hadn't proved necessary. Clough offered an amazing proposal. After dark, he and One Yard would creep inside the NVA position, leave the Nightingales with a two-hour time delay, then sneak back. Howard thought it unbelievable, but if Buckwheat wanted to go for it, well, all right. It took 7 hours of slow, stealthy movement, but Clough and One Yard crept among the 500 NVA, activated the two-hour time delay fuse, then rejoined their team. All at once, those damned devices started going off, and it was the biggest firefight I've ever heard in my life, Howard recalled. This son of a bitch goes on for at least an hour and a half or 2 hours, and it's starting now to break light. Eventually, enemy officers got their men to stop their wild shooting and flee, probably fearing an airstrike. When Howard passed the empty bivouac, "It was unbelievable," he reported. "We found dead bodies everywhere." New insertion extraction equipment improved operations, too. First Sergeant Norman Doney took aluminum cable ladders off Chinook helicopters and adapted them to SOG Hueys, which allowed teams to land or come out wherever a Huey could hover 28 feet above the ground, forcing the enemy to disperse LZ watchers. But the most revolutionary emergency extraction development was the Maguire rig, invented by the man whose name it bore, Special Forces Sergeant Major Charles Maguire. The rig was simply a 100-foot rope with a 6-foot loop at the end and a padded canvas seat. He rode it just like a playground swing seat. A single Huey carried 4 Maguire rigs, or strings as they were called, 2 on each side. Not only were they faster than any winch, but 4 men could be lifted at once. All the pilot had to do was rise vertically until his string passengers were above the jungle canopy, then fly away. A team could be lifted through any canopy hole wide enough for the crew chief to see the ground. Strings could not be used on king bees, though, because they caused a serious balance problem to the H-34. During an extraction, the Huey pilot had to hold his bird at a steady treetop hover while his crew chief, lying on the aircraft floor and peering down, directed him over the hole by intercom. After dropping the ropes, the crew chief watched the recon men climb into the seats, then told the pilot when to lift up. A dangerous few seconds because the ropes could become snared in the trees, or a sudden barrage of fire could threaten the aircraft. Sergeant Charlie Dodge of the 57th Assault Helicopter Company explained, "If you got in trouble with the strings, the crew members would have to cut them. That would be the only way the aircraft could fly free. It didn't matter if anyone was on the ends of the strings or not. If you had to cut the ropes in order to save the aircraft, you cut the ropes. That was understood by everybody." Riding strings felt a bit like being Peter Pan, a magical climb better than any elevator, but your weight soon shifted to the crotch, eventually cutting off blood flow to your legs. There you were, swaying below the Huey, 3,000 feet above the jungle, the air rushing past at 90 knots. USAF Lieutenant Colonel Dean Stretch Balmes, a Pleiku-based A-1 pilot, will always remember the first day he saw anyone ride a Maguire rig. Piloting his Sky Raider, he rushed to a Laotian hillside where a SOG recon team had been run to ground by an NVA company. He found the men in a bomb crater, frantically flashing a signal mirror, just as the NVA launched an all-out assault. Balmes and wingman Don Dineen rolled in with cluster bombs, but they hit too close. "Damn," Balmes told himself, "that's going right through the bomb crater." The team was not hit. After the team was safely lifted away in Maguire rigs, Balmes dumped the rest of his ordnance, then climbed up behind the Hueys to fly back. Looking up through his canopy at the odd spectacle of men riding Maguire rigs, Balmes almost had a heart attack when the Team 1-0 suddenly hung upside down, swung like a chimp on a trapeze, waved to Balmes and shouted into his radio, "You sweet motherfucker!" The many recon men's lives were saved. Several men were injured or killed when dragged through trees or when they fell from strings. An especially tough case was that of Lieutenant Jim Burcham, lost 15 November 1968. Burcham and a young Special Forces NCO had been lifted out in darkness after a long day of running firefights against determined NVA pursuers. Both were wounded but managed to lash themselves together in the only McGuire rig they could find. They would hold on to each other. The Huey lifted safely away but had to fly through a heavy tropical storm so violent that at times the whole aircraft shuddered. It was pitch black. When the storm-shaken helicopter finally descended back in South Vietnam, a waiting party rushed to the mass of ice-laden clothes and gear in the McGuire rig, but found only the unconscious, shivering young NCO, rope burns cut deep into his hands, where even his superhuman grip had been insufficient to hold Lieutenant Burcham. "He had terrific rope burns," recalled the recon company commander, Captain Ed Lassane. "It was an impossible human task to do what he did, but I'm sure he feels guilty as hell that he dropped him." Jim Burcham's body was never found. After several McGuire rig fatalities, First Sergeant Norman Doney added a wrist slip loop, which helped, but men still fell. Eventually, three instructors at the 5th Special Forces Group's Recondo School developed the solution, the Stabo rig, an acronym for their names, Major Robert Stevens, Captain John Knabb, and Sergeant First Class Clifford Roberts. The Stabo rig replaced a man's web gear with a special webbed harness. To be extracted, the soldier unfastened two straps on his belt's back, swung them between his legs, and snapped them securely in front. When the helicopter dropped a rope,